As a filmmaker, more than anything, you're a storyteller and you're looking for good stories. And Winnie is somebody who's loved by millions of people, who made a lot of people very happy, who ended her life very tragically. And there's somehow a disconnect between this very beautiful young woman who started and the woman who died. And I guess I went out to try and find out how to explain what happened.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Today, we're setting off in search of one of the most legendary performers of the century, Whitney Houston. We'll talk to co-director Nick Broomfield about his new documentary and the dark side of celebrity. Plus, Brian Cox and Miranda Richardson reveal what they learned about the concept of leadership after stepping inside the shoes of one of Britain's first couples, Winston Churchill and his wife, Clementine.
It's a traditional marriage and a non-traditional marriage. For better, for worse, you are the support, if you like, behind the throne, sort of.
And later in the show, we'll fire up the bat signal to farewell Adam West with our top five reasons to revisit his 1966 big screen outing as the Caped Crusader.
The game's up, Riddler. As a duly deputized agent of the law, I place you under arrest for armed robbery.
Snap on the bat cuffs. You've got me, Batman.
That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
In June 1944, Britain was on the brink of one of the most uncertain periods of its history. With Allied forces stationed on the south coast, ready to invade Nazi-occupied Europe, all eyes were on Prime Minister Winston Churchill as they awaited his decision on whether the invasion would proceed. Yet, while the British people saw in him a strong and decisive leader, privately, Churchill was struggling under the weight of responsibility. Terrified of repeating mistakes from the First World War and plagued by depression, the Prime Minister was, in many ways, himself on the brink of a personal crisis.
And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle. Until in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. This dark chapter in Britain's history provides the setting for the new film, Churchill, starring Brian Cox as the iconic leader and Miranda Richardson as his wife, Clementine.
What will you say tomorrow?
I don't know. Depends on the news.
No, it doesn't. Whatever happens tonight, you must give them hope.
I sat down for a chat with Brian and Miranda and started by asking them how stepping inside the shoes of these historical figures informed their views on what it takes to be a leader.
Well, I think that the one thing that you can't forget is your humanity. I mean, you don't forget your humanity. It's present. It's omnipresent. It's there. You know, your history is there. It speaks for itself. And Churchill had an astonishing history. He had the most incredible rises and he had the most incredible falls. He was flawed. He was a very flawed individual. He wasn't popular. He hadn't been popular. He was popular now because he was the great rallier. You know, his broadcasts are second to none. I mean, his broadcasts alone are his great legacy. I mean, how he boasted the country through that horrendous time. I mean, I can't even imagine it. I wasn't alive then. But, I mean, I know my parents went through it, and it was, you know, it was fairly hairy for everybody. But he also stood up against fascism. He stood up against Hitler. And in a period when people really didn't want to go to war, because he'd also been the president of the First War, and the First War cost so much. I mean, 20% of the population of my hometown, the young men, just vanished. All of that history is there, and it's not without cost. He's not, and he wasn't an insensitive individual. He was a highly sensitive man, but also a bit of a genius as far as his political thinking was concerned. So in a sense, all of that is there, and all the contradictions are there, and the fact that his rhetorical self was a kind of construct. But all of his, when you think about it, the look, the hat, the cigar, the V sign, that was what he presented. That was the front he presented. So there was the other side of him, the depressive, the man who drank copious amount of alcohol. As I say, the black dog, the lack of sleep, 3-4 hours a night. His serotonin levels must have been ridiculous. So that creates a really human picture.
Miranda, it often seems like that it might have been a more difficult job for Clem to be married to Winston than it was for Winston to be prime minister. She has to go through quite a bit. I mean, we know quite a bit about Winston Churchill as a leader. We know perhaps a little bit less about Clem and who she was. How was that for you to inhabit a role like that one?
It's very exciting because it feels like you're breaking new ground, which is always a main thrust for me when going to do a job. She deliberately kept her light under a bushel because it was all about pushing the great man forward. She recognised his capability and his very particular qualities, and that he was a visionary, and that he was a genius and a dreamer, and was very bad at looking after himself, so he was going to need somebody. It's a traditional marriage and a non-traditional marriage. It's sort of traditional in that, you know, it's for better, for worse. You are the support, if you like, behind the throne, sort of. But it's modern in that they allowed each other to be themselves. The fact that she had her own particular interests during the war, the Red Cross for Russia Fund, and was also a marvellous ambassador. She met Eleanor Roosevelt, and she had a particular way of dealing with people, which was sought after by the men who were around Churchill. They came for advice, they came for solace, because she was a woman. She was embodying all sorts of things for the nation.
It's a tricky situation, though, I think, when we're playing, when First Ladies are portrayed on the screen, because it's sometimes difficult to portray them as maybe fully rounded, proper characters and not just playing second fiddle to their very well-known, very powerful husbands. Was that a concern for you when you were crafting your performance in this one?
It's always a concern, but I wish there were more. But it was a really interesting script in that we are looking behind the scenes and we are looking into the core of people, but people who also had a sense of the times, duty, morality, principle. And courage.
And she was no second fiddle.
She was no second fiddle.
She really
absolutely.
Was no second fiddle. She was vital.
They had a volatile relationship, but that meant that there was an honesty there, which is great. You know, that's part of a marriage, I'm told.
No, I mean, in that sense, it was a very modern marriage.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a real partnership. And they were really soulmates, you know. I mean, he couldn't, particularly by 44, he was pretty frail. He'd been ill at the end of 43. He'd had pneumonia, and therefore he was not at his best. And given this decision that was coming, which he himself was ambivalent about, but he had these demons from the past, and the demons from the past are proven by how he dealt with the past, because as soon as the disastrous Dardanelles campaign was over, immediately after that, he went to the front, and he was a major in the Royal Scots Fusiliers. So he had that was a penitent act. That, and the contention of this film, didn't leave him. And I could believe it. I could believe it, because the whole notion of amphibious landings was something that he really questioned. So that, given his age, given everything, this is where Clementine was absolutely vital. And I don't think he could have achieved, I don't think he could have got through those 4 days if it wasn't for her.
you speak about his physical frailty. There's also an emotional frailty that's explored in the film as well, and you see the partnership really coming into force between Clem and Winston during that time. That's something that's perhaps less explored when we talk about Winston Churchill a lot. He's always been considered a very strong leader, which of course he was, but you know, there was this other side to him, wasn't there?
The strength comes from his humanity. You know, it's his humanness what makes him strong. But also, you have to understand that there was the legacy of Churchill. And the legacy of Churchill, and Clementine was very, very much responsible in keeping that legacy intact. So, for example, we see this 96 hours. But as far as the public was concerned, it didn't exist. And as far as they were concerned, when he makes that speech at the end of the movie, the last 96 hours simply did not exist. That hadn't happened. And that was what she was responsible for. Mm. They moved onwards. And that was their relationship.
She protected him during his time on this earth, and she protected him after he had left this earth.
You've stepped into the shoes of two historical figures. Given today's current context and the timing in which we're speaking, do you have any advice for the leadership of today on how you can stick together and maybe stick it through?
Be moral, be consistent, be principled.
That's it. Moral, consistent, principled, clarity of purpose, less self-aggrandizing. There's not enough concern for the community. They do tokenism. You have it in America with this clown that they have over there. And here we have the same. But there's this gap. Especially in this country, there's this gap because we're still very feudal in this country. So we still have those old feudal values, which should be gone. They should be got rid of. Until that can happen, we cannot have a proper balance of a culture. You know, this is a multicultural society, but it is not allowed to be it because of the old feudal crap that we have.
A wonderful pairing indeed. That is Brian Cox and Miranda Richardson there. Churchill is in theatres this week. Still to come, we will discover a new side to the legendary performer Whitney Houston with the co-director of a new documentary about her life. But first, a look at this week's box office report. The decision makers at Universal will be shaking their heads in disbelief this week after The Mummy delivered weaker results than expected. With a budget of $125 million, the film took just $31 million on its opening weekend and failed to nudge Wonder Woman from the top spot, which took over $58 million in its second weekend. The Mummy is intended to be the first in a reboot of the Universal Monster franchise, though if the critics are to be believed, you might be better off avoiding Tom Cruise and revisiting the 1932 original as part of Universal's classic monster movie Blu-ray set.
For heaven's sakes, what is it?
He went for a little walk. You should have seen his face.
This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned. Maverick British filmmaker Nick Brimfield became best known for his investigative documentaries such as Kurt and Courtney and Biggie and Tupac. His signature style of appearing on screen, often with the sound boom in hand, as a way of making sense of the events he set out to uncover, has been influential to many documentary makers since. His latest film, Whitney, Can I Be Me, is a careful return to the more observational style seen in his earlier work, utilising largely unseen footage filmed by Rudy DeLazel and interviews with people close to the star herself. Pushing aside the notion of the star's celebrity status, the film presents an intimate portrait of a woman who just happened to be the most awarded female artist of all time. Before, of course, her tragic death at the age of 48. In this report produced by Monocle's Yolien Goffin, director Nick Brimfield takes us behind the lens of his new film, all about Whitney Houston.
As a filmmaker, more than anything, you're a storyteller and you're looking for good stories. And Whitney is somebody who's loved by millions of people, who made a lot of people very happy, who ended her life very tragically, and there's somehow a disconnect between this very beautiful young woman who started and the woman who died, and I guess I went out to try and find out how to explain what happened.
Whitney was at the top of the charts. She had 7 consecutive number one records. She was everywhere.
I got to hear about Rudy through one of the bodyguards who mentioned that there'd been this guy around who had complete access. But it took a long time to find Rudy. I don't think Rudy wanted to be found. And Rudy wasn't very interested in, you know, just selling his footage. So it took months and months and months of trying to get a hold of Rudy. And it was only a year ago. I was already filming for a year before I met Rudy. And it was only this time last year, just around Cannes, that I went and saw him and realized that he had this treasure trove of footage, which he let me put in the film, and he's credited as a co-director on the film. For a long time, what was missing from the film was her voice and her emotions and her being. And I think you just want to be with Whitney. You want to feel as much of Whitney as possible. And I think the reason the film is as moving as it is because you really feel Whitney. And the more you feel her, the more emotionally transported you are by her story.
They had a vision for a pop artist.
They wanted to present her as the princess.
I did not go into the studio wanting to make a pop album.
She was closer to her dad.
But Whitney had the career that her mother always wanted.
Whitney was born at a particular time, a time when there weren't many massive black artists that were loved by white audiences. So she cleared the way for people like Beyoncé now. And she paid a very big price for being the first one. This image of who Whitney Houston was created by the record company. And of course, she was a very different person to that. It became increasingly hard for her to live with that image, the image that had been created. And then the white audience and the white press believed that she was this American princess. So when she kind of was accused of being a lesbian and people disapproved of her relationship with Bobby Brown, it was like she hadn't lived up to what was a completely fictitious creation anyway, which was Whitney Houston. She was a different person. I don't think the complexities of being a black star have changed that much because America is still deeply racist, and it's very hard for black artists to kind of get out of their background. I think with a black artist, their family, their friends all expect them to kind of be a meal ticket out of wherever they come from, which doesn't apply to white artists, you know. So there are a lot of differences, and there are a lot of things that still would be very hard for somebody coming out of a place like Newark, which is where she was from. This is much more, although it brings up, I guess, issues of homosexuality and, I guess, race from Whitney's background and stuff. It's very much more focused on Whitney and Whitney as a person. It's a much more of a portrait. I didn't feel that I needed a lot more. I sort of felt I had put a lot of pieces of a jigsaw puzzle together, which kind of made sense to me, and I believe it's the true story. I want people to love Whitney and to celebrate her and to be moved by her story.
Nick Broomfield's new documentary, Whitney, Can I Be Me?, is out this week in cinemas. That report was produced by Yolene Goffin. Still to come on The Cinema Show, the top 5 reasons to revisit Adam West's big screen outing as the very camp caped crusader. Stay tuned. If last week's international edition of The Cinema Show has left you hankering for a holiday, well, MUBI has you covered with an international array of great movies. New to the lineup this week is the tense 2012 French title, The Sinkholes, following a distraught woman on her exploration of a sinkhole that's opened up beneath her bed. Then we take off to Canada with the documentary The Boy from Geita, telling the tale of a young Tanzanian boy cast out due to his albinism.
and the bond he forms with a Canadian man who just happens to have the same condition. And then it's off to the Philippines for another slow cinema treat from Lav Diaz, the 338-minute epic From What Is Before. Check our archive for a special Q&A with Diaz recorded at the Regent Street Cinema here in London. And of course, you can sample a whole month of MUBI right now. Just head over to mubi.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. Finally today, the bat signal has gone a little dim this week after the death of the incomparable Mr. Adam West. With its colourful comedy and clever campiness, the 1960s television series helped prove that Batman wasn't merely a children's character. Comic books could indeed be sophisticated. The Batman series became a cultural phenomenon almost as soon as it premiered, with Adam West even appearing on the cover of Life magazine. Despite its brief three-season run, it's remained eternally relevant. So, as we farewell Mr. West, let's switch those atomic batteries to power and turbines to speed with five key reasons to revisit Adam West's 1966 big screen version of Batman. Starting at number five, we have the Rubber Shark. Those of us who can remember seeing the farcical 1966 film version of Batman can recall a classic scene involving the Caped Crusader struggling against an aggressive rubber shark as he dangled precariously from a ladder affixed to the Batcopter. It's only after the resourceful Robin locates a handy can of shark repellent and passes it to Batman via a feat of rope ladder acrobatics that the dynamic duo are able to pull off their remarkable escape. At number four, it's the Batpoles.
To the Batpoles.
It's a very sad fact indeed that the Batpoles are no longer part of Batman's elaborate subterranean setup. Though the Bat Signal made the odd appearance here and there, for the most part, Gotham's dynamic duo was summoned by a flashing red telephone situated on Commissioner Gordon's desk.
It's the Bat phone, sir. Thank you, Alfred, for reminding me.
A brief conversation was usually followed by Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson racing to the Wayne Manor study to reveal a matching pair of fire station-style poles hidden behind a sliding bookcase. Aside from the endless chuckles to be found by fans who noticed how much larger Bruce's pole appeared to be compared to Dick's, there was for a time confusion as to how the duo were able to return to Wayne Manor. That, of course, is where the compressed steam bat pole lift came in handy.
Why, it's Alfred's burglar alarm. There must be trouble upstairs.
In third place, it's the Bat Vehicles. Now, of course, everyone remembers the incredible Batmobile as designed by George Barris. No episode of the series was complete without it. But when you're facing the threat of evil cats and penguins at the same time, a car just won't do. In the film, there's the Batcycle, with Robin riding alongside Batman in the sidecar. Plus, of course, the aforementioned Batcopter and the United Underworld team of scheming villains even managed to get their hands upon their very own submarine, complete with custom penguin-inspired livery.
You dismal bird, you and your submarine, where's it got us now?
Shut up, you feline fruity!
At number two, it's Lee Merriweather as the big screen's very first Catwoman.
You're going to see the perfect crime when I get Batman in my claws.
Now, this is one of the more contentious elements of the film. The role is, of course, most often associated with Julie Newmar, but at this point, she'd only played Catwoman in one episode of the show's first season and wasn't available for the film. In the dual role of Catwoman and her disguised alter ego, Miss Kitka, Lee Merriweather makes for a very fine feline fatale in high fashion.
Miss Kitka, I have the strangest feeling that I am about to be utterly and madly carried away.
Not quite as flirtatious as Julie Newmar or as wicked as Eartha Kitt, Lee Merriweather nevertheless brings her own sharp style of biff, pow, and zing.
Catwoman, stop my set!
I don't think you mean that, Batman. Miss Kitka dies if you take one more step. Go!
And the number one reason to revisit Batman 1966? Well, of course, it is the sharp, suave, smooth-talking, and perfectly clueless Adam West.
Robin, you haven't fastened your safety bat belt.
We're only going a couple of blocks.
It won't be long until you're old enough to get a driver's license, Robin. Then you'll be able to drive the Batmobile and other vehicles. Remember, motor is safety.
Gosh, Batman, when you put it that way...
His appearance on the cover of Life magazine on the 11th of March 1966 shows just how era-defining Adam West's Batman really was. His self-mockery and relaxed demeanor in the face of all manner of deadly situations was crucial to the series' ability to project sophisticated humor. No matter how ridiculous or campy a scene might become, West's Batman always persevered with the utmost seriousness. His Batman hadn't donned a cape due to some traumatic childhood. He was just rich and bored. It doesn't make sense to compare the Batman of the 60s with modern, darker interpretations. Like James Bond or Sherlock Holmes, this is a character that's been in a constant state of reinvention ever since the very first story was printed in 1939. But as we look back from the context of today's mega-budgeted blockbusters, it's easy to see why Adam West's colourful, campy, yet thoughtful approach made him an icon of popular culture.
It was satire for adults and social commentary, but for the children it was just excitement, adventure, and fun. People were looking for it, and they were screaming at checkout stands, "Get us out of here, Batman's on tonight!"
And that's all for this week's show. Don't forget to catch this week's episode of our new spin-off, Action, which is out this Friday. Today's show was mixed and edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. The Cinema Show returns next week, same bat time, same bat channel. I'm Ben Rylan. We'll catch you then.